Welcome to our show, Examine Life, on KKRN at 88.5 FM in Bella Vista at Round Mountain.
I'm Steve.
And I'm Pat.
Plato said the unexamined life is not worth living. Tonight we're going to examine energy.
And the views and opinions expressed on this program are of the speakers and do not reflect the views and opinions of the radio station, KKRN, its management, staff, or underwriters.
Just us.
Just us. And we are going to talk a little bit about alternative energy, what they refer to as renewables. And those are other than fossil fuels like coal, oil, and natural gas. All of them are converted to electricity as a secondary energy.
And apparently California is having a little too much success with promoting solar, private solar. I thought California's main desire was to increase solar use so fewer polluting power plants would have to be built. They put incentives in place to promote private homeowners and businesses to install solar, and the program was very successful. It actually cut power use in the state. Many of us who installed the solar system are trying to be part of the solution, not the problem. I spend a large amount of money myself that I don't have to spare to help the environment. I would think that my lowered use of electricity will already save them some of the cost of power production. And PG&E themselves agreed that the solar initiatives helped. So now they want us to pay a new fee to ostensibly help pay for the maintenance cost. So I ask, why do I need to pay more to maintain the grid? Shouldn't those who own homes and choose not to extend themselves to help the environment be the ones to pay the extra fee? To any of you out there who promote the idea of living green, I say this. If you own a home and have not installed solar for your house, then you're part of the problem, not the solution. Even if you're a renter, you should not choose to live in a house where the owner has not solarized. Yes, it's a cost, but you can do it with a loan, or you can even make arrangements where the solar company becomes your utility, and you have panels.
And that's a leasing arrangement.
Right. And they maintain ownership, and you just do what's right for the planet. There is a plan for almost every situation. If you're paying electric bills now, there's very little excuse. Put your money where your mouth is. If you don't do this one thing, you cannot call yourself green.
And we can't just look to the government to do and fix a problem that we're each contributing to. If we're not willing to change, we have to be part of the solution, and we all need to do our part. And the Obama administration has a climate change plan that supports alternative energy. And Governor Brown just signed a bill to make California create 50% of its energy from renewable sources by 2030.
And now we have PG&E and others, trying to get the CPUC to import fees on people who do solar because they share the grid. But we're saving them from some of the costs of building new plants and so on. So why should they do that to us?
Well, they're backstepping, and it's going to have a negative effect on a lot of things, even if you have a stock account that has an ETF for alternative energy, solar, wind, or anything else, that stock's going to take a hit.
And it actually already has. The solarization rate, I guess you would call it, in California since the initiative started was going up. And California was one of the highest solar rates in the country. And then they started talking about this fee back in 2013, and immediately the rate of people solarizing their homes started to drop. So they're defeating their own purpose.
Well, when you think about it, if you entertain the idea of solarizing your home, and I don't care if it's a water heater, you're going to heat your swimming pool, you're going to have a solar panel open your gate or do a well. All of these things are an investment on your part. And the PUC should be glad that you're doing that instead of saying, oh, well, now we're going to charge you a fee. And oh, by the way, if you give us any of your power back into the grid, we're going to cut in half the amount that we compensate you.
Which wasn't that high to begin with.
No, because they had dropped it like 5 years ago down to 8 cents or something. So they keep dropping that. And I know that a lot of it has to do with these big solar farms. They can buy energy relatively cheaply per kilowatt than buying it from you or the average homeowner.
But the point I made in my rant is that if you truly believe that we need to save this planet, then if you haven't solarized your living space, then you're not serious about it. Well, we all can do that. And think if every home and business in the country had solar on its own individual structures, think of the power savings.
Well, the government has set aside 22 million acres in California to support renewable development, and they hope to generate 20,000 megawatts of electricity on federal land by 2020.
So think about the fact that because all of you out there who aren't solarizing your home, now we have to have this big ugly thing on our forest and our lands because we're not doing our part as private citizens.
Well, the land's just sitting there anyway. You might as well generate power.
It won't be green anymore. And by the way, speaking of green, just so we're all aware, you know, more than 46 million pounds of waste, and we're talking about toxic metals and so on, was generated from solar companies in California between 2007 and 2011. 97% of that waste remained in California. But 1.5 million pounds of it was shipped to other sites around the country. And, of course, there's a lot of ungreen energy in the trucks that did all that shipping. So just to make it clear that it's not totally green and totally safe, but it's still a good option for helping our planet.
And we have other ones. We have solar. We have wind. We have hydro, geothermal. There's a number of different ones. And we're going to talk a little bit about all of those tonight. The federal tax credit that right now is 30% for solarizing, for example, that's going to drop to 20% at the end of 2016. So there's motivation for you to look into that solar option now, as opposed to waiting for another 2 years when that will drop to 20%, and who knows how long we'll continue to have it. But there are 2,100 major solar operating plants in the United States. And all of them combined only generate 0.58% of all of the U.S. electricity. That's less than 1%.
Right. I think the grassroots thing is the answer, though. My comments about private solar, I think that's the way to go, because all those farms and so on, you can only fit so much no matter how much acreage you have. But if every single home and business building had it, I think that number would go up drastically.
And I think California is promoting business rooftop solar. There are a lot of huge companies, corporations that are doing this, as well as schools that use are generating a lot of power. And I hate to say it, but I hate to see the PUC backcharge them for doing the right thing and putting power back in the grid because of their excess.
Yeah, it's a typical thing, a big business, and you know the CPUC's president had to step down, and the information that I was able to glean about that had to do with the fact that the relationship between PG&E and the president was a little too suspicious. And again, it's what we need to do is stop the cronyism and just deal with the fact that if we encourage people to solarize their homes and businesses, they'll do it, and the problem will be solved. We have to have this complications with fees and reducing the resale rate and all these things. Why can't it just be simple?
Well, the oldest solar plant is in the Mojave Desert. It's about 40 miles southwest of Las Vegas, and it was financed through a loan guarantee at $1.2 billion, and that it is producing now 392 megavolts of electricity, and that's fabulous. That's a great investment, and that was done by the Department of Energy, that loan guarantee. So there are ways of getting that financing done for these large solar farms. And by the way, they use heliostats, which are those mirrors that focus the energy onto boilers that actually create the electricity. It's fascinating.
Right.
There's a lot of different kinds of solar plants.
Yeah, the Albert Einstein actually was a big part of making solar panels possible. The Nobel Peace Prize, not that this is of any value to anybody but me, but the Nobel Peace Prize that he won was for the photoelectric effect, which describes why solar energy can be gotten from metals or from silicone.
And in 1905, he discovered mass could be changed into energy.
Right.
Yes.
And the problem was his theories of relativity were so far beyond the current scientists of the Nobel Committee that they couldn't give him the Peace Prize for that, which he deserved. They later gave it to him for the photoelectric effect just because they had to give it to him for something.
Yeah, he was quite an inventor. There is also what they call a molten salt thermal energy storage, and that is where molten salt runs through pipes in a kind of a concave bowl design, and then that salt is stored underground so that it can be used overnight. So it's a 24-hour plant that produces power. And one of those was also built in Gila Bend, Arizona in just 2013. So there's a lot of technology that is causing new ideas to come around in solar.
Yeah, so we need to all participate. I think grassroots is always best. I don't think large, giant plants or plantations are a good idea.
I think they're a great idea. It's a great use of public land. It's also like the one in out in the desert. Mojave is a desert. There's also one out in near Joshua Tree. It's called the Desert Sunlight Farm. And I realize it's huge. It's on 4,000 acres, which is probably the biggest one. In fact, it is the biggest one. It's the largest one on public land. And it was built in, just came online in 2014, at the end of 2014. But it generates power for 160,000 homes. And, you know, that's a good idea.
Well, but what if those 160,000 homes were generating their own power? You could still enjoy the desert.
But just think, the $1.4 billion that the government was a partial loan guarantee to build that plant, and they now have PG&E and California Edison have 20-year contracts to buy that power to service those 160,000 homes. It's easier to do that than to convince 160,000 people to put solar on their house.
And that's the problem, because half of those 160,000 people are all screaming about how we need to be green, but they're not being green.
But not everybody can be, and this is a way that the Department of Energy, who has done extensive loan guarantees, not all of them good, of course, but they're helping to solve this problem. And the new technologies that are coming up, they have that parabolic, I think, trough in Nevada, that they generate power. It's one of the largest in the world, in fact. And it's a new design of generating power from a different thing other than the photovoltaic cells.
Well, I think a lot of people will agree with you, because we have a lot of people living in cities now, and they really don't care what the countryside looks like anymore. So the majority would agree with you. I just believe in nature, and the houses are already there. They have solar on them. We're not destroying the beauty of our... I mean, this country has incredible landscapes, and we're covering them up.
Well, yes, and...
And desert has an innate beauty of its own.
Yes, and I have seen the plant out near Las Vegas. We drove by it, and it is huge.
I've seen it, too.
I mean, there's these giant mirror-like things out there, discs out in the middle of the desert, and it's fascinating. But we have a vast desert. You know, we can afford 4,000 acres of it being used for a solar farm.
For now.
And there's only 29 permitted solar projects in the Southwest, and they do have 8 more coming online. But we have a lot of homes here to provide power for.
Now, do you feel the same way about wind power?
Yes.
About wind farms?
Yes. I think, you know, Bernie right down the road here has that Hatchet Mountain wind farm that was just built in 2010. And it has 44 turbines creating power, and it services 10,000 homes.
See, I'm always amazed with people blurting out that science says, and I don't know that I'm pro or con the wind farms. You know, I kind of like robotic looking things, but they say that they don't affect the wind patterns at all. I don't know how they can say that with a straight face. Anything that is in the wind changes the wind patterns when you have enough of it. And actually, even if you don't have enough of it, you get the butterfly effect. But, and I'm not saying it's good or bad, but to say that it doesn't affect the wind patterns is just ridiculous.
Well, I think in the, like you say, the butterfly effect, the infinitesimal amount that it does, when you consider that wind blowing over Hatchet Mountain at 100 miles per hour, turning those 44 turbines, and these are 3-blade turbines, and it's really Is it really affecting that 100-mile-an-hour current?
No, not that specific current that's passing through there at the moment. Do you know why they call it the butterfly effect?
Yes.
Why?
Because the little tiny infinitesimal change over time exaggerates.
Affects somebody 2,000 miles away with a hurricane.
Yes.
So what if it turns out to change air currents in such a way that global warming is sped up? How do you know it? You can't know about it because that's why the butterfly effect is so fascinating.
That's true. So I'm not going to argue with you on it. But how a wind farm works, let's talk about that. There's a three blade, usually they can be less or more, but they're commonly three blade propellers, and it's on a tower. And usually that's a steel tube, giant steel tube, and it goes up at least 100 feet above the ground. So it gets up in where the current, the strongest current is, wind pattern, and that turns a motor, and that has gears to increase the revolutions per minute to about 1,800, and that's connected to a shaft that spins a generator that actually creates electricity.
Right. Yeah. It's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. And so I
drive by those fairly frequently. I never seem to see very many turning, but I guess it's maybe they're all there so that some of them are turning some of the time and others turning at other times. I don't know, but I never see much spinning going on.
Enough to generate power. The largest one is in Oregon. It's called Shepherd's Flat, and it has enough power to create energy for 260,000 homes. That's a lot of houses. And that was also financed by a partial loan guarantee by the Department of Energy in 2010 at only a cost of $1.3 billion. And, you know, I would rather see our government do these kinds of systems to spend our money on. These are local businesses. I mean, a lot of these parts and stuff are made in the United States. These keep people employed in the United States. I'd rather see them spend their money on this kind of thing than some of these other crazy studies that they do.
Well, technically not their money, but
our money. Okay.
And I don't know how it's actually being spent, so I'll not discuss that. I'm curious, though, something I didn't bother to look up, and I apologize. These wind farms, for instance, or solar farms, do they actually always produce all of the power for those homes that we're talking about, or are they supplemented by the grid, and how much every year?
They're supposed to replace the power, the equivalent, from the grid. So instead of those 260,000 homes drawing power from the grid, they're drawing power from the wind farm.
So 100% of their power.
Supposedly.
Okay.
I don't know that if it's actually that efficient or not, but that's the theory is to reduce the carbon footprint. We also have the U.S. coastal water winds can generate up to 4,000 gigawatts or four times the current electrical system. But we don't harness much of that, the coastal water types. There are three projects that are proposed right now for 2017 to offshore development of these wind farms. The ones in New Jersey, Virginia, and I think a couple are in Oregon offshore. And they're, again, being financed by the Department of Energy. They each are getting $47 million to build the facilities. And that's financed over 10 years. And so those will be coming online, hopefully, in 2017. And California has the third largest wind farm in the United States. And Texas has the biggest one, and Iowa has the next one. In fact, I think Iowa generates something like 30% of their power from wind. That's a lot.
How many endangered birds do they kill, I wonder?
I don't know. How many birds are 100 feet off the ground? Most birds fly that far?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I know some of the hawks in our area fly at least that high.
Well, don't like geese, they are higher than that. They're migrating. Aren't they higher than that?
Until they land.
Yeah. I would think they could see a wind farm and miss it.
Well, you would think any of them could see a big thing like that.
Well, all the new technologies in wind actually have increased the capacity of wind power from 22% prior to 1998. To 32% from just turbine technology. So, and they say that wind power only costs 6 cents a kilowatt. That's fantastic.
I wonder how that's calculated. Who said that?
This is all from the Department of Energy.
Oh.
So it's the kilowatt hour.
I know I can trust them.
Yes, you can.
Okay.
You can. That's where we spend our money.
Hmm.
You don't
we
have,
do.
Have you been to or seen any of the wind farms? Have you been by the one in Burney?
Oh, yeah. I told you. I drive by there fairly frequently.
I find them fascinating when I go by and see them. We've been by one out in the Palm Desert area, a huge farm up on a ridge. And it's fascinating. It's like looking at a whirlpool of water or something. You're just mesmerized by it, and you want to just keep looking at it.
The one in Burney, I'm assuming there's a certain percentage of them that are supposed to not be turning, because I go by there and I might see one or two of them turning sometimes, other times a few more. Walmart has one down by their big plant south of Red Bluff there, and that one I never see turning, so I'm not sure that it's even actually active.
It might not be. I know some of them, all of them have governors on them, so they can't go too fast because there's a certain point of, you know, they need not to go any fast. I know just a basic home windmill, we had one that was originally connected to a pump, a water pump, a well, water well. And it had to have a governor on it. Of course, it was wooden, but because it would just blow out, it would just keep turning until it, you know,
right.
break off.
Yeah.
So I'm sure the big ones have the same technology issues. Did you want to take a break and then we'll come back and talk about hydro and all of those kinds of things?
Well, we could take a break, I guess. It's about 23 minutes after the hour. On Wednesday, October 21st at 8 p.m., the first airing of a new locally produced program, Strictly Vinyl, with Sammy, Joe, Gabriel, Brian, and Steve playing the old sounds on LP. Popping, hissing, rocking blues. Oh, yeah.
Look forward to that this week, folks. We'll be right back.
Give me a kiss to build a dream on, and my imagination will thrive upon that kiss. Sweetheart, I ask no more than this. A kiss to build a dream on. Give me a kiss before you leave me, and my imagination will feed my hungry heart. Leave me one thing before we part. A kiss to build a dream on.
Join the discussion. KKRN boasts a variety of talk radio, both from local and syndicated sources. We want to stimulate thoughtful and meaningful conversation. KKRN can offer more real conversation because we are supported by listeners. You have a voice.
Make them believe they're true. Oh, give me your lips for just a moment, and my imagination will make that moment live.
The infinite possibilities of music are showcased by the eclectic panorama of song styles that you can find on KKRN Radio. You won't find our musical explorations on more mainstream commercially driven stations. From classic country to new age, from classic folk to classic rock, from blues to jazz, and music from outside our country. You'll find it all on KKRN listener-supported radio, radio that makes you listen.
Hi, you're listening to Examine Life on KKRN at 88.5 FM. And the views and opinions expressed on this program are of the speakers and do not reflect the views and opinions of the radio station, KKRN, its management, staff, or underwriters.
Tonight, we're talking about energy in all of its forms.
Mostly alternative.
And we've been talking about rational things, but me being a bit of a science fiction nut, I have to say that there's a couple of interesting things coming up. I read some recent articles on the Navy believing they can use a process, which actually happened back in the early 2000s, where they can convert seawater into jet fuel. Now, I have some environmental concerns about that. I know that back in my day in the service, I ran a fuel control lab for a while on the Kitty Hawk. And if I detected more than 5 parts per million water in the fuel, they would dump something like 2 football field tanks full of JP5 right into the ocean. But on the other hand, I had a jar in my lab that was half full of seawater and half full of JP5 jet fuel, and I found organisms eating the fuel and living in the water. So
did it emulsify?
It's split. It's separated.
Because
JP5
yeah.
is like diesel fuel.
Yes.
So another interesting thing that I've run across, and by the way, that business about the jet fuel from the seawater, apparently that was something someone discovered while researching cancer treatments where you can use radio waves to cause hydrogen to leave the water.
And ignite.
Yeah. And so another interesting one was apparently steam engines now are becoming of the size that could be put in where an internal combustion is put into a car right now. So that's another thing that could be on the horizon. And possibly steam-powered electrical generators for the survivalists out there among us, like myself.
Well, that brings us back full cycle to water, hydro, which is the oldest power source, is a stream running and spinning a wheel.
And that's pretty darn renewable. And if you don't like water power for some environmental reason, then you shouldn't like wind power.
Yeah. And the Greeks used it 2,000 years ago. And as early as the 1880s. They used to have lighting at Niagara Falls generated by direct current using the falls. So hydro has been around a long time, and it's fascinating how simple it is, how basic.
Gravity.
Yes, and we had a friend that was taught survival training or survivalist in the outback of Australia. And one of the things that was big was any size creek was to put a pipe in it that would force the water to spin something at the other end of that pipe and create some sort of power.
Hmm.
So they use it even in the outback there.
Yeah, and it's perfectly renewable. You know, the water goes downstream, it gets absorbed back into the atmosphere, comes back up in the mountains, and the whole thing starts again. And that, of course, like everything on the earth, is a form of solar energy.
Yes. And hydro is, like you say, old. In 1893, they had the development of alternating current, and that would allow energy to be carried long distances.
Good friend Tesla.
Yes. Yes. And
Edison spent a lot of effort and killed a lot of animals trying to prove how dangerous his alternating current was.
Yes. Thank goodness that we still use it today, too. And California had the first commercial hydro plant in California. Where all those
Which
new
one
things.
Was that?
I don't remember which one it was. I know they had the direct current used in mills in Wisconsin and, I believe, in Michigan. But we had the first commercial where they would sell the power.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting story in itself, how the big battle over whether to use direct current or alternating current. And alternating current always made better sense, but there were people's businesses and dollars involved in it, and they wanted to put I think you could only transport direct current about 1,400 feet or something, whereas you could do alternating current for hundreds of miles. And Tesla had an uphill battle trying to convince people to use AC.
Thank goodness we did.
He won. He was a genius.
Washington State gets 70% of their power from hydro, and 7% of the U.S. energy comes from power from hydro. That's 14 times more than solar, and 50% of all renewable types of energy is hydro powered.
Sure, because it's just utilizing what's already there in nature. It doesn't have to be built like a solar panel or a wind farm or something like that. It's already there. We're just sticking machines into it and letting them spin.
And most dams were originally built to control floods, flood water.
Before electricity.
Right, and to store water. And then we built Hoover Dam, the Army Corps of Engineers. That was one of the big projects to harness water, hydropower, to generate electricity.
Hmm. A neighbor of mine lived in one of the northern states, which bordered on Canada. And they built some dikes, kind of like dams, up there to protect from flooding. and the local politics got involved, and some of the local businesses wanted to use to do something with that water, and so the dams eventually came down, and they ended up flooding a large area, and a lot of people lost a lot.
A lot of local
governments cronying up with local businesses.
Well, a lot of people forget that the reason dams were built originally was to control floods. It wasn't just to, you know, make fish go around. It was really for the benefit of farming and everything else, so that everything, all that topsoil wouldn't get washed away all the time. And only 3% of dams actually generate power. Shasta Dam is run by the Department of Reclamation. And if you've never taken the tour down in the dam, absolutely do that. It is fascinating. How it works is there's two large There's two large dams that create power, and that's Hoover and Shasta. But water pouring through turbines in the dam actually is what creates the power.
Yeah, and just causes them to spin, and that's where you get the alternating current, is because they're constantly switching poles. It's very simple. People privately do it too. I know a fellow up in the Lakehead area that generates power in a local stream there.
Yeah, there are people that still use it. If you're, especially in outback like Australia and other countries where there isn't, the grid available or anything else, hydropower is one of the major sources of power. We forget again, the byproduct of them is water storage. We store a lot of drinking water behind Shasta Dam over and above. In fact, we actually don't use, Redding doesn't use power from Shasta Dam. That's federal, that's a federal dam, and it's their power. But it's considered a backup to the grid. They could generate our power if they needed to. But Hoover Dam does create power for the greater Las Vegas area and some of the downriver communities. There's also hydrokinetic power energy. It's from waves and tides.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think you'll probably have a lot of complaints about using that, because probably most of the people that live on the beach can't afford to raise up a fuss about having those kind of plants on their beaches.
Well, there's not a whole lot of them.
Or near their beaches.
Yeah, I was going to say the ocean or marine power is not too common. It's used in Maine to generate electricity from the tidal waves. But the Department of Energy has only funded $10 million worth of these projects. And they're still what they consider experimental on tidal turbines.
I remember about 10 or 15 years ago, since we're on the subject of energy generation, in New York City, someone did a study, and it was a technical study. It wasn't, about probabilities. It was an actual scientific technical study. And he believed that if they replaced all of the sidewalks in New York City, because, you know, of all the foot traffic they have.
Yes,
With plates, metal plates that were hooked up to spring-loaded magnets with coils around them, that they could generate, it was an incredible amount of electricity that they could generate just from the people walking on these plates constantly. Nothing ever came of it, but I thought it was a fascinating concept.
Well, even like, you know, you see these movies where someone is riding a bicycle to keep a radio going or something like that. So, I mean, there are ways to generate power that is not what we automatically think of turning on a switch.
Right. I had an idea once for a car, and I think my wife came up with something similar for a class of hers, where you operate everything in the car with your hands, and where your feet go, there's pedals where you can generate electricity to make your car kind of a semi-hybrid and save some fuel and keep fit at the same time while you're on long road trips.
Uh-huh. How many of us would do that? Probably not too many.
Not too many.
Harnessing the ocean is still too costly. Most of these are pilot programs. Alaska's entertaining one. So is New York. But the force of the ocean is unpredictable. The tidal waves, we know when they're coming in and when high tide is, but we don't know how forceful, how big, how strong. There's also the crustacean problem of growing on anything. The salt water has a corrosive effect. The climate, if there's a storm, that changes everything. So right now, what they consider it's too costly to do ocean stuff yet.
Right. And I don't know that it's a good idea, actually, but I guess it depends on how desperate we get.
Well, there's big oceans out there. They cover the majority of the world, and that they're perpetual. That current, those tides, they are perpetual.
But again, I still believe that you know, tides and winds and things like that, even solar, there are effects on the environment of all of these things, and we don't know what those effects are. It's just like the idea of, you know, one very well-known and very, very well-vetted meteorologist believes that in the early 2050s we're headed towards a mini ice age. And it could be that, you know, global warming could offset that to some degree. So we never know for sure what effects any of this has. So things like tides, I agree with you about the salt and the corrosion. I don't know that it'll ever really be a viable thing. And how productive can it really be? I'm concerned about this idea of the Navy of using ocean water to make jet fuel, because you're actually breaking the water down. And, you know, even a little thing like the United States Navy could end up using a little too much of the ocean to make jet fuel.
Well, think of all of the countries, not us so much, but we do have them, that have freshwater desalinization plants. That's using literally using the water. It's not the waves or the currents, but it is still, we benefit from the ocean. If we put our minds to it, we can solve the problem.
Right. Yeah, we should be careful about which resources we're using. When we use, you know, hydroelectric plants, the water's coming down anyway. We're not really stopping it. We're slowing it down. Again, it probably has some effect that we don't know about. But that, to me, is a little more intuitive than something like using the ocean for electricity or for desalinization. You know, all of that water, I'm assuming, will go back into the atmosphere, you know, so I don't know that it's harmful. But we need to think about these things and not just assume that it's all okay because someone says it is. That's kind of my bottom line.
Well, we have another alternative, and that's geothermal, which is heat derived from the earth. And the largest one of those is here in California. It's called Alpine Geothermal. And it sits atop some geysers that spans Lake and Sonoma counties. And it was built in 1960. And the steam actually runs turbines over this 45-acre field of stream that comes right out of the ground.
Yeah, and that's because we have a very volcanically active state.
And all that steam actually generates power for the city of San Francisco.
Yeah.
So they use a lot of it.
We have geothermal is another one that I think is probably a good idea. It's you know, it derives, like everything else on the earth, the geothermal comes from, it's a form of solar energy, but what's interesting about it is it's not the sun's heat so much that generates our geothermal heat.
No.
It's the tidal forces of the gravity of the sun and the moon that generate our, because it causes the fluctuations in our crust and so on, which generates heat. And
yes,
that's a big
core.
Part of why that heat is in the core.
Yeah, the core of our planet actually emits the heat that creates the steam. That particular plant uses 10 million gallons of recycled wastewater to generate the natural occurring steam reservoirs to regenerate them. And it's the second largest energy producer in all of California. It's amazing. It's a hydroelectric plant.
Yeah.
And
You mean the geothermal?
I'm sorry, geothermal plant. And the Department of Energy is actually collecting data, and it's, if you go to the website geothermaldata.org, they're studying the potential wells, all kinds of wells, not just water wells, but gas, thermal, oil, all of these kinds of alternate power generating wells. So if you want more interesting information, that's a good place to go.
Mm. Well, we don't want to talk about oil wells too much.
No. But our next topic is
nuclear. We do also have probably ethanol to talk about, but it is a hydrocarbon, so perhaps we should not.
Well, I take exception to that for other reasons than that.
Yeah, we have to talk about, I think we have talked about those to some degree. nuclear is a fascinating thing because, you know, there is a lot of politics involved in nuclear. But, you know, we talk about the dangers and Chernobyl and things like that, which we're going to get into. And Pat's done some research on that. But in France, you know, you don't have these problems. The biggest problem with nuclear seems to be the storage of the material because
the waste
doesn't go away for a long, long time. And it's very heavy. You know, sci-fi nuts like me say, we'll just throw it in the sun, which would be a viable option, but you got to get it into orbit first, and it's very heavy.
Yes. And all nuclear power plants use fission type, which is splitting of uranium atoms, releasing heat that can generate steam to turn a turbine to create the electricity, is how they basically work. All of our nuclear power plants are fission. There is... you don't have to use uranium. You could use plutonium or thoridium, which China, Russia, and India are exploring using those types of atoms instead of uranium.
Yeah, fusion's a whole different thing. Most people don't realize fusion. If we could cause fusion in the proper way, you don't get the radioactive danger out of fusion that you get out of fission.
But it's controlling it.
Well, yeah. The problem is that it takes a fission nuclear bomb like Hiroshima to ignite a fusion bomb. I don't think most people realize how big a fusion bomb really is, but they can't maintain the process in a controlled way yet because it takes that much energy and there's no way to produce that much energy. In the end, it would be beneficial in terms of energy output, but they just don't have a way to maintain that energy and keep it bottled up. That's the problem.
A simple way to describe it would be two or more atoms, nucleus, colliding at a high speed, and they join to form a new atomic nucleus. And this new nucleus is converted into photons, and that produces energy. It's how stars and the sun emit.
Fusion.
Yes.
Not fission.
Fusion, that's right, yeah. Fusion. And it's not used currently in our nuclear power plants because it's not a stable process now.
Right, yeah, we can't maintain it. A couple decades ago, we had the big cold fusion. I don't know if you remember. Everybody thought this one university had come up with a way for slow fusion to take place, and it was all kind of a hoax. But, you know, it's still on the horizon. They're still working on it, and I believe all scientific problems are possible. And if we ever do it and we don't get politics too deeply involved with it, fusion power may be the secret that is going to take us into the next level of human evolution because it won't produce the kind of radiation that fission produces, and it's a lot of energy for a lot of bang for the buck.
Yes, in fact, even fission energy can release a million times more energy per atom than fossil fuels. So,
oh, yeah.
One uranium fuel pellet creates the same energy as a ton of coal.
Yeah, no, fusion, even fission, is much higher because it's converting, both of those are converting matter directly into energy.
Yes.
And matter is just a compressed form of energy. So they have a great potential, but they both have their problems.
Nuclear power actually represents 63% of the U.S. emission-free electricity. And that we get from 104 different plants in 30 states around the United States. But it's only 20% of our electric generating fuel.
It's funny how they call it emission-free because they're looking at smokestacks or something, and they don't realize that every time you take nuclear waste out of one of those plants and have to store it, essentially that plant is emitting that chunk of nuclear waste. But they call it emission-free, and it's probably one of the most polluting things on the planet because it sticks around for probably 100 years.
Well, the radioactive waste does, but it emits no greenhouse gases, and
right.
That's why
they call it emission-free. But
yes.
I'd rather be around a greenhouse gas than a brick of depleted uranium.
Well, we've not built a new plant since Three Mile Island disaster in 1979. And it's because it took them 14 years to clean up that mess, and it was the first nuclear disaster from a power plant. But there's five new plants on the horizon. They're being built in Georgia, South Carolina, and Tennessee, and they have nine more applications to build 14 new reactors. So there, it's coming back. It's on the horizon. It has large power generation at a low operating cost. Once you get that plant up and running, which of course costs $6 to $8 billion just to get that plant built, but once it's done, the operating cost of that plant is minimal.
It's kind of fun watching the battle with people who are kind of politically into these kind of things, you know, struggling with themselves over the lack of greenhouse gas emissions, but the concern about the waste and so on. And they really struggle with that.
And the radioactive, you know, all our nuclear power plants have these 4-foot wall containers over the dome containers that are steel and concrete. But there's still, you know, we've had 3 disasters in history. Not, you know, we've only had one here in the United States. That was Three Mile Island. But Chernobyl in 1986 in the Ukraine. Of course, it was part of Russia then, but it contaminated. They said that they felt it 700 miles away from Turkey to Ireland to Sweden.
You mean and the radiation?
Yeah, they could detect it in the air 700 miles away, and it killed over 100,000 people. And 2.5 million Iranians still live with health issues. Some of the things they did, not knowing. They would process beef or cattle that had dead black organs in them, and they would still process the meat and sell it as food.
Well, I mean, that's the Soviet Union in a nutshell. Human life was not as valuable as the state, and that's why many of us are against this concept of everything for the state, because that's what you get. You know, everything is based against the state.
Well, we also didn't know a lot then that we know now. A lot of people died, you know, of thyroid cancer, and they still are developing cancers. But ironically, we now know that if you're exposed to any kind of radiation like that, that 90% of it's going to be absorbed by your clothes. So take your clothes off,
right,
and you will get rid of 90% of the radioactive material because your clothes will absorb it.
Right. Yeah, we know a lot more now. I mean, in the Japanese disaster related to the earthquake, you know, what did they lose? Did they lose anybody, or was it 2 or 3 people? It was a very small number.
Right, but the combination of the tsunami and the earthquake and that caused the actual meltdown in 2011...
Meltdown is an interesting term because that's what we've always been afraid of, but it's never actually happened. What a meltdown does is the core of the nuclear plant literally melts its way to the core of the earth, which to me sounds like problem solves itself. So
just put a cap on that.
Yeah,
right?
So I'm not sure it's a bad thing. I saw a story once about a crazy survivalist type who built a shelter against nuclear war, and he was a typical, the way they portray those guys, just a vicious, mean, selfish guy, and he had his shelter, and they had a nuclear alert, so his wife and kids and everybody leaves, and he's determined to stay in his shelter, and it shows him years later, and they're still in the shelter, he's still in the shelter, and the radiation's not going down like he expected it, and then it comes out of the view of the camera comes out of there and comes to his wife and kid who are standing on the ground above this valley. And they domed over his whole area, and that's why the radiation was still out of control. And it turned out it was just a nuclear accident.
Well, 3 million of us live within 10 miles of a plant. But they say, scientists say, we get more radiation from our TVs and computers in our lifetime from those two things than we do from living within 10 miles of a nuclear power plant.
Oh, yeah. I think the safety features are actually pretty good. I mean... you know, there's always ways for disasters to happen of different types. You know, we have all these oil spill disasters. We probably will have more nuclear disasters. You know, we'll probably have a dam break. I mean, the dams are a place for terrorists to go. I mean, there's just a possibility of things. But what you do is you try to protect the public as well as you can.
Well, one large nuclear facility produces enough energy for over 700,000 homes. And that uses only 20 metric tons of uranium a year.
Right.
So it doesn't use that much. And the average facility pays $16 million to state and local taxes and an additional $67 million a year in federal taxes. That's why power is so expensive from a nuclear power plant is the taxes.
Well, they're doing the same thing with the gas taxes. The price of gas goes down. They want to put more taxes on it. And then when the price goes up, oh, well, too bad.
Well, it's just, you know, the biggest problem with nuclear power plants are the spent fuel rods.
Right.
And they have to change those out every 18 to 24 months. And that alone creates 22 tons of those fuel rods that have to be stored.
That's the problem with nuclear.
Yes.
Yeah, they've got to store them for hundreds of years.
Yes. And ironically, most of them were stored in Illinois. And there's a huge pool that they're concerned about in North Carolina that they submerged them in. They've talked about the Yucca Mountain in Nevada that is going to be the next dump site because it's underground, and they feel that it can be contained better there. It doesn't, you know, there's no aerial access or there's no evaporation of the water like the one in North Carolina. And most of them are stored in steel-lined, water-filled concrete vaults.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's what Yucca Mountain will have, but there's a lot of protests in Nevada about not using Yucca Mountain for it. And most of a lot of that has to do with they have to bring them in by rail. And to move them across the country, you go through a lot of cities. And we've had a lot of rail crashes in the last decade.
Interesting trivia fact about John Wayne and the cancer that he had. And the belief is that it was actually caused by the nuclear test site in Nevada where they were shooting a movie. And some of the other actors in that movie ended up with the same with cancers. From radiation poisoning.
Yes, they believe that that's true. And who knows, it may have been. We didn't know that much about it back then, about the debris sites. In Nevada, a lot of the testing, nuclear military testing, was done underground and above ground initially.
Right.
A lot of, historically, you know, the Manhattan Project out of Chicago in 1942 showed that... that's where we built the first nuclear reactor.
Right. They were in New Mexico, I think, was where the project actually took place.
Well, they built the reactor in Chicago, apparently,
right.
In 1942. But the Russians had the first nuclear power plant for electricity in 1954. We built our, of course, in 1954, we built it with the USS submarine Nautilus.
Mm-hmm.
That was our first nuclear submarine. And we had our first nuclear power plant in 1957.
And there, I remember when I was a kid in the 60s, I was into some geeky things, and they had nuclear reactors planned for spacecraft and for satellites and so on, so they could power them for a long time. Most of them, I think, are powered by solar things now, but they call them SNAPs for space nuclear atomic plant.
Well, a lot of the research was done for military purposes, not for domestic nuclear power plant generation of electricity. But that's kind of the byproduct of it when we initially started it out for military purposes.
Sure, just like the internet. The military comes up with a lot of technology because they want to always be at the leading edge, and so they create these things, and then we find all these other uses.
Like the U.S. Navy with the jet fuel.
Right, right. And even the space program, you know, wasn't technically military, but it was. I mean, you know, it's just, who wants to be the one up in orbit that can drop rocks on the other people, you know?
Yes.
It's the way it works.
I do want to say one thing about ethanol. It is considered the diversion of the production of farmland is the biggest argument against it. And it has driven the cost of corn very high because we are using so much corn for the production of ethanol rather than for food. In fact, I think it's less than 10% of all the corn grown is for ethanol and not for food.
And ethanol, by the way, for those of you that don't know, is a hydrocarbon.
It's a biomass.
It's a hydrocarbon.
Yes, but it's in our gasoline now, and I just don't understand the purpose of ethanol. I don't see how it benefits all of us in society or benefits our environment, and yet we continue to have huge plants with ethanol.
I think it's because instead of having a rational scientific discussion about it, it goes back to political camps. Both sides have their political agenda, and neither side is willing to actually do the real research and speak the truth.
But ethanol was, I thought, originally produced to minimize our carbon footprint and our carbon emissions from our cars, pretty much. So how is that possible when it is, you know, carbon-producing? It seems ironic.
It may produce less carbon, but the problem it does, I think it produces fewer hydrocarbons. But here's the problem. It has about 30% of the energy output that other hydrocarbons have. And so you end up producing the same amount of pollution to drive the same number of miles or produce the same amount of electricity, whatever you're using it for. It actually has a bigger carbon footprint when you take into account how much of it you have to burn in order to achieve the same energy output.
Speaking of carbon footprints, how do you like that hybrid car you have?
Well, you know, my wife made an intelligent choice. For some reason, I'm fixated on the idea of how the brakes in these things work. You know, they actually, when you brake the car, the braking itself generates electricity to power your batteries. That just fascinates me, which is why she doesn't like me driving her car, because I'm always playing with it, trying to figure out to maximize the mileage, and she's like, concentrate on your driving. And I'm playing with the car, trying to get it to produce maximum mileage. But I love the car. She made a very wise choice.
So it runs on electricity
and fuel,
but starts on fuel.
So it has a bad. It's weird because I can't hear her coming home, so I can't do anything that I might feel guilty about. So because it's quiet, but the gas only runs when the batteries reach a level of depletion.
I see.
And so it has a very small gas engine. And the gas engine is both running the car and charging the batteries, or both can be running the car when you're going up a hill. So this little thing has all the power we need it to have.
Interesting.
Hybrids are amazing technology.
The views and opinions expressed on this program tonight are of the speakers and do not reflect the views and opinions of the radio station, KKRN, its management, staff, or underwriters.
And one more time, Wednesday, October 21st, 8 p.m., the first airing of a new locally produced program, Strictly Vinyl, with Sammy, Joe, Gabriel, Brian, and Steve, not this Steve, playing the old sounds on LP, popping, hissing, rocking blues. Oh, yeah.
I'm Pat.
I'm Steve.
You've been listening to Examine Life on KKRN, 88.5 FM in Round Mountain at Bella Vista.
I hope we've given you some information, some things to think about. And remember, it's one thing to talk green. It's another thing to put your money where your mouth is. I'm challenging all of you out there.
Good night.
TTFN.